Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary. Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. Now, in the last couple of months, I've looked at some of the origins of fascism, and now we are moving on to looking at the evolution of variants of European fascism, why it is different fascisms emerged in Europe in different ways at different times, or within a few years of one another from the first fascist party being founded in Milan in 1919. Once again, we're looking at Roger Eatwell's work, Fascism and History, and he writes in The National Roots of Fascist Movements, "The first self-styled fascist movement was founded in Italy in 1919. Within the space of a few years, most European countries witnessed the creation of their own fascist parties. There's some, including Hitler's National Socialists, either rarely or never referred to themselves as fascist. To understand why they took different forms and why some prospered and others failed is necessary to begin with the story well before the First World War and to examine specific national traditions. Stressing the importance of political traditions does not necessarily involve believing that national identity is written on tablets of stone or coded in genes. Nations are diverse organisms capable of evolution. Political systems, too, are not rigid structures. Parties rise and fall, and constitutions change. Even so, some political systems clearly have firmer roots than others and are more capable of sustaining shock or of marginalizing challenges. And the past shapes the present in a variety of ways. It helps to define what is familiar rather than what is alien, what is legitimate, what is unacceptable. All crucial factors in understanding the actions of political leaders and the masses." So here what we're doing is we are looking at the relationship between national traditions and the kind of origins of political institutions in countries, particularly Germany and Italy, and the development of fascism in those countries. Now, fascism itself, the term that emerges in Italy, fascisti, the fighting squads, it has a particularly Italian context. When the term gets bandied around and used to describe anyone and everything, it really is divorced so far from its initial terminology, its initial meaning, as to coming to not mean anything at all. And it was for this reason that whilst Nazism can be described as a variant of fascism, it was not described by the Nazis as fascist itself. This was to them an Italian term, just as other political parties in one country now wouldn't appropriate the language of a similar political party or the terminology of a similar political party necessarily from overseas. So being able to distinguish, being able to look at different national traditions helps us to kind of like filter out what features of, say, Italian or German fascism happen to be kind of accidental or things that we might imbue too much meaning into when perhaps there is less there than might first appear clear, or which actual traditions of local importance really kind of mean something. So today we're going to really focus on Italy and Germany, but later on we're going to look at the development of interwar French and British fascism as well. Just because Britain never fell to fascism didn't mean that it wasn't prevalent in British society and have a great deal of traction, which it indeed did. Britain is an interesting one because Britain has crafted itself in the post-war year as the as an anti-fascist nation. However, the reality was that during the Second World War, much of Churchill's considerations about domestic politics were based in the knowledge that there was a significant body of people in Great Britain that had antipathy, if not bigotry, towards the Jews, and that had certain sympathies with fascist ideas. Perhaps this doesn't necessarily mean they had sympathies with Germany, but they had sympathies with a variant of British fascism, which was far more to do with white racial colonialism and the British Empire. So one of the things about Germany in the period from 1871 to 1918-1919 was that much of its historical development, as Richard J. Evans argues, was kind of compressed. It had a relatively short historical journey towards the development of modern institutions. It had been divided, obviously, throughout the 19th century into small states, of which by 1870, Prussia was the most significant one. But it had existed since, obviously, Frederick the Great had been, and all the way back to the very beginnings of European civilization and the Holy Roman Empire. It had been the site of the Reformation. And so German nationalism has a very long story. And all nationalisms and fascisms tend to do this. They tend to look back to the long story to find answers to present dilemmas. And fascism always promises the embrace of what is kind of cherry-picked from the past in order to have a kind of a revival moment in the present. Of course, no discussion about the historical roots of nationalist and fascist thought would be complete without Bismarck. Otto von Bismarck, the Chancellor of the new Imperial Germany and the architect of German unification, Roger Eatwell writes, "The key individual in the later stages of this process of unification was Otto von Bismarck. Bismarck became the first Chancellor of the new Imperial German Federation, which was created after the triumph against France in 1870. Predictably, given the authoritarian Prussian tradition, the political system over which he presided was far from democratic, even by the standards of the day. The head of the state was the Kaiser, who, together with the court and unelected groups such as the landed gentry, the Junkers, wielded considerable influence behind the scenes. The rapid rise of German industry, which was soon to eclipse that of Britain, was bringing other forces into play. By the late 1870s, a tacit alliance had emerged between landowners and industrialists to impose protectionism and to force the government to stem the growing tide of socialism." So the development of an organised working class movement in Germany created amongst the landowners, amongst the industrialists and the upper classes, a political will to resist them at all costs. And the development of socialism placed pressures upon the authoritarian conservative world that Bismarck had been had created, when by the late 1890s, early 1900s, the Social Democratic Party emerged as the main electoral force in Germany. Part of the process of unification and the surge in nationalist passions resulted in a growth gradually of anti-Semitic thought. Now, the thing about Germany, one of the paradoxes, is that prior to the First World War, despite there being a development in anti-Semitic thoughts, these kind of growing kind of obscure scribblers at the fringes of society, still, in comparative terms, compared to Russia or France, Germany is not a particularly anti-Semitic society. What Germany is a society convulsed by nationalist, expansionist and imperialist ideas. And it is a society in which there is a significant number, particularly of young men, who grew up in the decades after unification and felt that they had missed their opportunity for the great manly adventure of unification. And part of their frustration was directed against minorities, of which the German Jews make up 0.5% of the population, many of whom were highly assimilated and had saw themselves as German and saw themselves as being part of a German society, integrated into almost every level of kind of professional life. And so the question about German anti-Semitism after World War One really is a question about the toxicity, the political toxicity of the war and its ending and the stab in the back myth and all this sort of stuff. Germany, much like France, much like Britain in the 19th century, was far more inclined, German people were far more inclined to define German identity ethnically, by a question of race, a question of blood. And this is one of the machines, one of the kind of the ideas that drove unification forward, you know, that people in Bavaria have essentially the same ethnic identity as people in Prussia, even though over these big expanses this was often not the case and they were kind of culturally quite different. But it was a kind of a unifying idea that automatically requires finding the other, finding those to exclude. And one interesting aspect of this period of time is the development of leagues within Germany, new organisations designed to further the goals of German nationalism. For example, the Navy League and the Pan-German League, which some historians have read slightly too much into. They have viewed them as kind of proto-Nazi organisations, which I don't think is possible, really. You need for the radicalisation, the political radicalisation of the First World War, really for kind of Nazism to exist.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, That plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Though they did have ideas, similar foreign policy ideas of expansionism and Weltpolitik and the seizure of Eastern Europe, the creation of Lebensraum Eastern Europe as the Nazis. But the fact of the matter is that Hitler was not an original thinker. He was somebody who lazily and easily cherry-picked reactionary ideas from the past 30 or 40 years of German writing on the right-wing fringes. There were people similar to Hitler who didn't receive the same level of prominence and publicity, who did basically the same thing. There's an entire generation of people who had read many of the kind of the pamphlets and booklets of right-wing scribblers and reactionary stuffed shirts and kind of old colonels and things like that. And Hitler was the person who was able to set it all out in Mein Kampf, and he happened to have a friendly publisher in the guise of Max Amann. So what we can see is a series of social, economic and industrial tensions emerging between the upper classes, the ruling classes, and a new rising proletariat. As a result of rapid industrialisation, very successful industrialisation in Germany, and toxic xenophobic nationalist ideas taking root in an era of kind of radical national expansion and warfare. So Germany has all the ingredients for the development of fascism, but what it needs really is this kind of crisis moment. The thing, if on the other side of the First World War, and this is where we kind of step into Russia, into Italy as well, is the Russian Revolution. So the First World War that produces defeat, that produces the stab in the back myth as explanation. That same war also features the Bolshevik Revolution and the fear that that would at some point be exported to Germany, and that this ties in with various kind of Hitler's ideas of Judeo-Bolshevism, that the villainous Jews would somehow bring the tyranny of Bolshevism down upon Germany, and that in Hitler's eyes would be the moment at which the Jews would wind up undoing all that it was to be German. Now, an interesting parallel with Italy is this kind of short time period in which political institutions are established. The Risorgimento, the period of reunion and rebirth of Italy, that finally ends in 1870, results in an Italy that's fundamentally different than that which its prime architects, Giuseppe Mazzini, had in mind. During the 1840s, the likes of Mazzini had hoped for a series of liberal nationalist revolutions across Europe, where nation-states would emerge, and constitutional republican governments with a rule of law and limited powers for the state would emerge, and this would be ideal. Of course, what you get is a nationalist revolution in Italy as a result of the decline in the power of the Habsburg Empire. But instead of that, you winding up with a liberal state. The state that emerges is a highly authoritarian and conservative one, which is deeply kind of in the thrall of the Catholic Church, and the Catholic Church holds the kind of the sword of Damocles over the state by the Pope refusing to recognise its legitimacy and saying ultimately to Catholic voters, this state is illegitimate because it has taken property from the Catholic Church in the guise of the Papal States, and don't vote for it. So it was fundamentally undermined from the start. Also, the physical unification of North and South was never what Camillo Cavour, the Prime Minister of Piedmont, had ever envisaged. What he had hoped for was a union of the wealthy northern states of Italy, Piedmont, Lombardy, Venetia, places like that, with the south, the kingdom of the two Sicilies, could go and hang. And if what emerges as a result of Garibaldi is a union of the wealthy north and the poor south. So you have two countries, essentially two Italies, fused into one, where there is immense social conflict and tension, a rising socialist movement, a rising trade union movement, industrialization in the north and poor peasant conditions in the south, which again creates similar kinds of tensions but more accentuated. When the opportunity to engage in the First World War comes along, the former socialist and populist journalist, he hasn't really transitioned to fascism yet, but Mussolini, as a journalist, began to agitate for war, along with a generation of other kind of pre-fascist politicians of his age, because he believed that war would turn the people in Italy into Italians, that war would forge national unity, national sentiment, and that struggle was what was required. Roger Eatwell writes, during the first decade of the 20th century, a new Italian nationalism emerged, especially among intellectuals. The best known figure in this movement was the author Gabriele D'Annunzio, though before 1914 he spent much of his time outside Italy. More important in terms of forging new organisations were Enrico Corradini and Giovanni Papini. Corradini was hostile to parliamentary government, which he saw as weak, divisive and corrupt. He denounced bourgeois society as unheroic and ultimately doomed to defeat by more disciplined and martial societies. Initially influenced mainly by Germany, after Japan's victory over Russia in 1905, his eyes turned to the new sun which was rising in the east. Corradini sought to found a new Shinto-like secular religion based around a mythology of nature and heroes. He believed that Italy, like Japan, was a proletarian nation, potentially strong and coming force which would overcome a decadent rival plutocratic powers. In 1910, Corradini was speaking of a national socialism, which could appeal to the working classes by offering new economic opportunities both at home and in Italy's colonies. It's really interesting how, and this is a kind of a trope that carries on through much of Mussolini's discourse, all the way to the Second World War, that France and Britain had were plutocratic powers. They were powers run by essentially wealthy elites, which isn't far off the mark in some regards, but this had left them kind of weak and sort of effeminate and pampered and unable to fight. The idea that modern warfare was about kind of industrial and scientific levels of organisation and not about manliness particularly was quite antithetical to Italian fascism, which really does explain Italian fascism's failings in warfare later on. But a new kind of movement based around warfare and labour and masculinity was what the likes of Corradini argued would be kind of the way in which Italy would kind of spiritually redeem itself, emotionally redeem itself. And the divided nature of Italy at the time and the economically backward half of the country was in some ways in fascist discourse tied in with this notion of effeminacy, that Italy was effeminate and weak and was being kind of dominated by other powers. And so a new way of thinking about things would change things. After the First World War, Italy that survives the First World War is one that is humiliated at the Paris Peace Conference. Many of the demands of the Treaty of London in 1915 that the Italians believed they were getting in terms of territory for participation in the war were broken, and the Italian delegation eventually withdraws from the Supreme Allied Council at the Peace Conference, and demanding the what they called the unredeemed or the irredenta lands. The belief that had prevailed in the war that the Italian intervention would be short, brief, glorious, and enough to get Italy at the top table was fading during the war, and instead the belief that the war had been a terrible disaster seeped through the Italian workforce, particularly those who had not fought but had put up with the kind of the inflation and other damage to their working and living conditions. Some soldiers, some officers particularly, who returned home in 1918 and 1919, returned home to economic and social chaos. And they returned home to striking workers waving the red flag. And their sentiment, their thinking was, we have been fighting at the front line, and we have come home to this. We have come home to you traitors, waving the red flag of the Bolsheviks, and this is obviously why we've lost. It is a kind of you riffraff at home. So the sort of the stab in the back myth, not that that term was ever used in Italy, well, there's a sort of a kind of like a variant of stab in the backism that was never in Italy anti-Semitic, and anti-Semitism really doesn't feature particularly in Italian fascism at all. It's exceedingly unpopular in Italy. But the belief that the working classes, particularly those who have listened to socialist agitators, have let the army down, stabbed the army in the back, and the idea that there is an enemy within, a traitor within, to be rooted out mercilessly, is what sees young men joining, some who have fought, some who haven't, joining the fascist squads in 1919. Okay, so that's just the beginnings of our look at the origins of European fascism. And next time we'll look a little bit at Great Britain and France and their development of fascist movements. Glad you've listened to this. I hope you've enjoyed it, found it interesting. I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Thanks, all the best, bye-bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.